These days, everyone who has a mobile device can take great photos and shoot videos, showing up all the time on Flickr, Instagram, Facebook, and a host of other social media sites. You point your phone and shoot a picture. Sometimes it's a hit, and many times it's a miss. So what separates the amateurs from the pros? For over 125 years, Dodd Camera has assisted photographers, both professional and amateur, with state-of-the-art cameras, lenses, lighting and darkroom equipment, and class instruction. You can learn about new equipment from their blog or attend one of the many in-store events. The folks at Dodd Camera are helpful, professional, and experienced. They'll take the time to answer your questions and give you advice you can use. You may go to doddcamera.com to find out more. And finally, we wish to thank Dodd Camera for sponsoring the Outspoken Cyclist podcast.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
And welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for January 13th, 2018. I'd like to introduce you to a new podcast sponsor. Over the past few years, we've talked about how exercise, especially cycling, not only improves your health, but continues to keep you healthy. It turns out that our healthy lifestyle can earn some points with life insurance. And so I'd like you to meet Health IQ. It's a different kind of insurance agency. You can go online at healthiq.com/TOC, read through the website. They want to help search out the best match for your lifestyle and your life. So take a moment to go online, healthiq.com/TOC. You get to learn more. You'll get a free quote to see if you qualify, and you'll help support the show. This week, we'll catch up with the iconic and ever reinventing himself, Ben Cerrada. Like the Phoenix Rising, Ben launched his new CerradaDesignStudio.com website on Monday, and I had a lengthy conversation with him about the new venture. We cover a lot of ground, including the bike models he's offering, why he chose steel and aluminum for materials, and which group sets he decided to offer. Then after our mid-show break, it's over to the French Riviera to speak with author and avid cyclist Max Leonard. Max's first book, Lantern Rouge, talked about the last rider in the Tour de France. In his new book, Higher Calling, Max recounts stories dating back to the beginning of Grand Tour racing and bringing us right up to the present as they relate to the seeming obsession cyclists have with climbing and the mountains. He talks of the victories and the defeats, great joy and deep sorrows in a beautifully researched and written history. This may just be one of those books you can't put down. So without further ado, let's head on over to Ballston Spa, New York, to speak with Ben Cerrada. Hello, Ben. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. Happy New Year and congratulations.
Thank you, Diane. It's great to be back and happy New Year to you as well.
I have been watching you drink endless cappuccinos through your Facebook page. And finally today, and I get to do this today, is the day you launched a brand new site. Talk to me about it.
It is, CerradaDesignStudio.com. It's my new virtual home, a place that I do stuff. And it's been a fun and sleepless effort the last couple of weeks, but I've got a great little team and you know, it's not perfect, but I think we're well on our way. Today we went live and are just starting to let people know, so I really appreciate your reaching out to me.
I went through the site today. I did find one, being the OCD editor that I am, I found one word that needed a T, but other than that, the site looks beautiful.
And did you notice that it had already been repaired?
No, I didn't go back. I was on my way to the street. You know, I did that one. I left the house coming into the studio. So good for you that you can get right in there and fix that. It's a nice site. It's very pretty. It's very Ben, black, red, white, just what I would expect to see. So tell me what it is Serrata Design Studio is all about.
Well, the reason I chose that name is because I realized that really what I like to do is more than one thing. I really do enjoy road bikes. I'll never tire of road bikes. But I also realize I like urban bikes. I have an interest in electric assist bicycles, and I have an interest in kids' bikes. By the way, I became a grandparent about a week ago. So I have an even greater interest in kids' bikes. And of course, I have an endless fascination with the human cycle interface and fitting and everything that is connected to that. I'm interested in many aspects of this cycling life. Serrata Design Studio, although the website right now really focuses on two bicycle models that have launched and are available, the name just sort of helps suggest that there's more going on behind the scenes than manufacturing and making available for sale those two bicycles.
So where is the studio?
Well, there's many places, Diane.
Oh, very cool.
So I see my studio as the variety of places that I'm at physically and mentally. I don't have one place that is my one skunkworks location. And this is one of the silver linings that has shown itself out of the last several years' transformation and letting go of this wonderful facility that I had. Right now, my facility has spent some time with Frank Welton as a shop, Frank the Welder shop in Vermont. Spent some time with Carl Schlemowitz at Vicious Cycles / Metal Groove at his shop down in New Paltz, and quite possibly other places. And Bill McDonald up in South Glens Falls in his paint shop. Then here in Boston Spa, New York, which is just a few miles from Saratoga, with my right-hand man, Sean, who is operations here daily. And we're, you know, messing around with bikes, and we were playing around with different sizes of tires and so forth. So sometimes it's here, and sometimes it's in Taiwan visiting factories there, and sometimes it's up on my bike on the road or on a trail. So my studio really is kind of all these places, or right down the street to New York. So it's the world that I draw on for ideas.
And that's interesting. We actually have relatives in Boston Spa.
No way.
Yes, we do. Yes, and she actually listens to the podcast every week. So a big shout out to Christy. How's that?
That's great. Tell her we're in the old chocolate factory.
Oh, that's cool. Is there any chocolate left?
If there is, I'm sure we wouldn't want to try eating it.
It's a really old chocolate factory.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell us a little bit about the two models that are featured on the Serrata Design Studio site.
The first model is called Amore Mio, which is three Italian words smushed together that essentially means my way. And that bicycle, in the model that exists today, which is called the C18, is a steel road bicycle, and it's available with either in a disc brake configuration or with rim brakes. And this bike is the new version, the modern version of and direct descendant of the original steel model that I called the Colorado. It was the first bike that I used multi-shaped, multi-tapered tubes, ovalized tubes. It really comes to the start of my moving away from using conventional tube sizes and shapes. And so this bike is the today's version. So I went back to Columbus in Milan, who's been my favorite steel supplier all these years. And really the tubing has been updated. It's a slightly different alloy, and the tubing is slightly thinner, but the diameters are slightly larger, really adjusted for the type of riding and the equipment that's used today. Knowing that most of the bike sales were likely to be with disc brakes, the frames have to be designed, should be designed, they not always are, but they should be designed for disc brakes specifically, not just with the mountings, but in terms of the strength and stiffness of the steel tubes, because there's just very different forces that go into the bike with disc brakes. And the fork that's on that bike actually is the same fork that's on our second model, which I'll talk about in a moment. I put together a part of my old band and a part of a new band. I'm working with Jay Clark, who's we worked together for quite a few years on design projects. We designed the fork from the ground up specifically for disc brakes, of course, because I just wasn't happy with what I was finding readily available in the marketplace. So the Moto Mio is a made-to-order only bike. We don't build them ahead of time. Everyone is produced to order. Anyway, that's the Moto Mio.
Before you move on to the other bike, I want to comment on and get feedback from you about this disc brake road phenomenon that's going on. So
yeah.
You obviously recognized what Brian and I talk about a lot, and that is how strong or not strong forks are given what's out there today. So what did you do different, if you can tell me, about this fork? And what was it that sort of tipped you off that the forks that were on the market might not work?
I've been watching this phenomenon evolve for probably since 2010 or 11 that it started to become a thing,
yeah.
I think. So this actually dates back to Shirata days as well in testing bikes. One is that disc brakes, unlike rim brakes, are very much on one side of the fork, one side of the frame. There's two things that have happened. One is because of the location, it's putting a torsional load into the fork and into the frame, but the fork is more susceptible to it, so that it impacts the steering and the shock absorption. If you're braking hard and going over bumps at the same time, it just, you know, the front end can be a little bit squirrely, I would say, is the best way to describe that. And some of the earlier first generation road disc forks that were out there, just or the fork would just sort of wind up underneath the bike. And so it just, because it changes the point of leverage. So it's classic of the bike industry to is making bicycles a certain way, and then somebody has an idea with a new kind of component, and it's okay, we'll put that component on the bike we already like. And, you know, it just fine if you're adding a frame fit pump.
Right.
But any component that interacts with a frame or fork can change not only how the bike overall performs, but also can change its potential for failure, premature failure. And in fact, that's what we you know, was evident in the marketplace. There were a number of forks that were not up to the task of disc brakes and either, you know, performed very poorly or had premature failures, which is why there's been some fits and starts in terms of forks that were available. So our doing our own fork, it's not my saying that no one else makes a reliable fork. You know, honestly, I don't know whether they do or don't. I assume by now companies that had poor first outings learned and have, you know, made corrective measures. But in something like the front fork, which is such a critical component, I'd rather have my own evidence.
Right.
It's more comfortable.
Right.
So the fork has to be stronger, you know, in that lower leg. Actually, throughout the leg, the brake is mounted to. But then the fork overall has to balance that. You can't just make one leg stiffer and leave the other one alone. Otherwise, you get this funky twisting going on. So the fork has to be stronger and stiffer, which means that the only place that you can really kind of counter that with providing a little bit of added smoothness is in the steering column. So so this is both bikes, whether a Moto Mio, even if it's a rim brake fork, we use a fork that has the carbon fork with an integral steering column so that there aren't separate parts that used to assemble the fork. It's all produced as a component. And it's an integrated tapered steering column.
Interesting.
And on the disc brake fork, to give the fork even added strength, whereas typically on a fork, the lower headset bearing is pressed onto the crown. This uses sort of the kind of what's become a mountain bike standard. The bearing seat is molded into the fork itself, so it becomes part of this tapered transitional area that goat moves from the fork legs into the steering column, which just makes for a stronger assembly.
Wow. I get it.
So these little details, you know, matter.
Yeah, they do matter. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Ben Cerrotta today, Monday, January, I guess it's the 8th, maybe?
It is the 8th.
It is the 8th.
January 8th.
Ben just launched his brand new website, CerrottaDesignStudio.com. It's a really interesting concept, and it's one that makes so much sense to me. So let's talk about bike number two, the Duetti. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, you did. You did very well.
Oh, thank you very much.
Duetti is the plural for a duet. And a duet, I think most people know, is generally two people playing nice music together. Hopefully nice music. They're playing music together, and when they're doing it well, it's a, you know, it's a lovely thing to experience if you're a music lover, as I am. And so the idea, the reason, the genesis of using Duetti means a series of duets, is thinking about what it's like having this relationship with your bicycle, the human and machine relationship. When things are working well, it's just a joy. I think most cyclists would kind of can relate to that. Yeah, for me, when I'm having most fun on a bike ride, it's definitely because I'm on a bike ride, but I'm not thinking about the bike. The bike is just sort of doing what I want to do. And in an odd way, I sometimes feel like I'm doing what the bike wants me to do. You know, when everything's going well, it's just this wonderful relationship that you have. So that's the genesis of the name Duetti. And Duetti S1, Series 1 bike, is a project that's actually been a couple years in the making. And I wanted to do a road bike that would be a little bit more accessible from a cost perspective than the classic made-to-order custom bikes. And what I felt was, still is, or has been missing in the marketplace is a bike that is easy to trust. And what I mean by trust is for the consumer to know that they're making a great choice without hesitation. And so I wanted to develop a road bike that was the perfect bike for today and tomorrow, so make it forward thinking in terms of design, as well as, you know, at the top of the list, make sure that the right size bike would be available for the vast majority of people. So this is where I got hung up a little bit. I realized that this can't be a 4-size bike or a 5-size bike, and to build something that would be somewhat cost effective and have quite a few sizes, making one piece carbon frames is really not an option, because to make a high quality carbon frame and true distinct sizes requires a full mold for each size. So it's hundreds of thousands of dollars of investment. What many companies do, you know, to kind of create the idea that they're made in many sizes, they have semi-modular construction. And so two sizes are actually really, really close to the same, but one has a taller head tube or something like that, for example. So I wanted to produce a bike that came in at least 8 sizes.
Yeah, but you have 11. Have
11 is the number. Yeah, and the sizes are sufficiently distinct from each other, so they're truly 11 different sizes. This Duetti started out as an idea, and then it started to become clearer and clearer and clearer, and I realized at a point that, well, that making this bike out of metal really makes more sense than trying to make it out of carbon fiber. And long story short, I decided that this should be, if I could find a way of making an aluminum bike that I really liked the way the bike felt and that I felt confident that I delivered a great ride and longevity, that aluminum was maybe an option. And that led me to finding the right material and process, which is really only done in a few factories in Asia, which led me to find a factory in Asia that was really enlightening to me. And what the Duetti is a modern road bike, but the bicycles are assembled to order. So it's sort of like analogy is if you, if you go into a store to buy a suit, there's sort of a medium level suit, like in the Brooks Brothers. There are all these suits on a rack, but they're just by chest size. And then you find the one that fits your chest, but everything else becomes tailored at that point to finish it out. And it's kind of the way I see this. So it's we have these 11 different sizes, but based on on a cyclist, overall dimensions, their flexibility, core strength, et cetera, how the cyclist needs to fit on the bike. Then we pick which of the 11 sizes is going to be the best platform to work from, and then we you know, outfit it with the handlebar and stem and seat post and so forth that puts them in the best possible position. You know, the Duetti is a modern road bike. And the other thing that I wanted to capture is making it simple. If you go on the vast majority of bicycle companies' websites, there'll be a model that comes in about 20 different versions, you know, all different price points, all different parts kits. And just to make sure that they're not never saying no to you, it'll be available in, you know, three different brands of parts kits. There's just so much similarity that it's overwhelming. And so with both bikes, we're actually only offering each in a couple component packages. And again, we're not saying that everything else isn't any good. We're just saying we know this is going to give you a fantastic user experience because we've tried everything and we have a huge amount of confidence in this. Buy the bike, ride it, and you won't have any regrets. So it's just trying to simplify the process. There's just way too much choice in the marketplace. The last thing I'll mention that I'm really excited about, this relates to both models and our little discussion about the fork, is we also decided one more time, because I tried this, 25 years ago, to reintroduce the notion that for a lot of people, a smaller wheel size is a big plus, not a negative. Cyclists, male or female, 5'4" and under, depending on proportion, very often that cyclist really isn't going to be able to develop a really nice pedal style unless the saddle is able to move farther to the rear than it generally is. Most full-size small bicycles have a fairly steep, fairly forward seat tube angle, just so that your overall body position is shoved forward enough so that the cyclist can get close enough to the handlebars without having too much overlap of your foot to the front wheel, which works, but oftentimes you just are at a disadvantage from a biomechanics perspective. And so the only way to deal with that really is to use a smaller size wheel. And just to reassure anyone who's listening who might fall into that category, or anyone who might be listening who thinks that they're going to be giving somebody advice, there's nothing wrong with a smaller wheel. It's just a matter of adjusting gear ratios. There's been so much debate over the years about which wheels are faster and which ones accelerate better and so forth. But all that is relatively minimal. What really is important is having a bike that the cyclist is able to be in the most effective position for power, endurance, comfort, and so forth. And that the bike underneath the cyclist has a great balance so that the weight distribution is proportioned properly. I made a decision not that long ago to plow ahead, and we're awaiting our sample. So that those bikes aren't in stock yet, but by the end of this month, hope to have the first of the disc brake forks, which will allow us to go ahead and make the frames.
So I want to remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Ben Serrata. He has just launched, literally today, January 8th, his new website, SerrataDesignStudio.com. Let's take a short break, and we'll come back, and we'll ask Ben some more questions. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'd like to thank our new podcast sponsor, HealthIQ.com, for supporting The Outspoken Cyclist podcast. HealthIQ is an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like us. Runners, cyclists, triathletes, even vegetarians get lower rates on their life insurance. All you have to do is go to healthiq.com/TOC to support the show. See if you qualify for lower rates. They use science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance, and the savings are exclusive to HealthIQ clients. So log on to healthiq.com/TOC. Support our show. See if you qualify. Thank you. We're speaking with Ben Serrata. I wanted to mention tires because smaller wheels, for many years, one of the drawbacks was not that the wheels were small, it's that the tire choices were so limited. And I think that that's changed, that manufacturers are now making some tire choices that are reasonable.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. And I wouldn't say it's changed, it's changing.
True.
I mean, there's two things. There's tire sizes, and there's also rim. There's tires and tire availability and rim availability. And I think there are maybe five or six sizes that fall into this 26-inch/650 BC mess. And so the standardization is, it's very, very confusing. And I won't mention which companies, but two of the most famous bike tire companies, I contacted their North American and European offices trying to get clarification on, you know, on certain dimensions of the tires, inflated diameters, and we were trying to match up rims and tires, and everybody's confused, even the people who are making the rims and the people who are making the tires. And so we decided to drive a stake in the ground for the smaller size at a rim diameter that's 559.
Right, which is 26 inches.
Right. And the reason I chose that is kind of the next size up, I think, is 584. It's just not smaller enough to make a real difference. You know, it's the radius that I'm concerned with, is the radius of the wheel that makes the difference. The whole diameter, of course, matters, but we're interested in the distance that we have from the edge of the tire to somebody's foot.
Right.
And then on the 584 size, of course, it varies with the particular tire that you have. You may be only gaining, half an inch or a little bit more, which is something, but it's not a lot. So the 559 just gives enough room to actually make it worthwhile. We found that Schwalbe, they are launching new tires in that size. So we spec this bike with a 28-millimeter tire.
Nice.
And our friends at Head Wheels weren't actively in production with that size rim, but they happened to have some that I guess Steve maybe was messing with. And they found these rims in the warehouse and built up some wheels, and they're just gorgeous. They're the same rim profiles on their Ardennes wheels, or Belgium if you just buy the rims. We've spec'd on as a standard item on both of our bike models. So I was really pleased with that. Anyway, to your point, the size, the tires are becoming more available, and I'm hoping that other companies that choose to join this rational mission will choose the 559 size, because it's, as I said, it's smaller enough to make a difference.
I wanted to ask you about the components you've chosen. You have chosen Campy Groups and SRAM Groups. So the other S name does not appear, not to say that I have any preferences, but I think of you as a campy guy originally, and SRAM seems to be coming on really strong. So do you have any preference for campy or SRAM, or you're offering both?
Yeah, so the other S brand, Shimano, makes great components as well. The good news and the bad news to consumers is there are too many choices, and there's a lot of great choices, but that doesn't mean it makes sense to have to wade through all of them. And so what I wanted to do was to pick a couple of choices that just made a lot of sense. And so if you really want electronic shifting, and you know where electronic shifting is going, is in time, I'm confident that brands who want to offer electronic shifting are going to be wireless, which has a number of virtues other than not having to have all these extra wires everywhere and connections. Wireless is also sort of pre-configured to be more Internet of Things friendly for people who just like being connected in every way possible and to be able to share information in every way possible, as well as program. So you'll be able to, in electronic shifting, if it matters, you'll be able to program your shifting to happen automatically based if you ride with a power system. You'll be able to program your bike so it shifts based on torque or shifts on based on speed, or you can integrate that as part of your training. And so if you like the idea of electronics, wireless is the way to go. And the best example of wireless today is the SRAM eTab. I've been using that for, about a year and a half, and have had absolutely zero problems with it, and, you know, really, really enjoy it. And I know it doesn't make me go any faster, but it works great, and I love how clean the bike is. And then the other side of the fence, and again, this isn't to say that Shimano electronics or Campagnolo electronics don't work well. I just think if you're going to go with electronics, get out of wireless. So I just sort of, I'm not worried about those others. Again, I'm approaching this is if I'm going to give a couple logical, great options to my customers, I should make it easy to make a decision. And the other feature that I really like about the SRAM ETAP is that there's a small battery on each derailleur rather than a central battery. And the small batteries are really light, and they're also interchangeable. Or you could carry a spare little battery if you're really concerned. You could carry an extra battery that work on either front or rear. If you really don't want to worry about one more thing to have to remember to charge from time to time, and really like the idea of being able to be a do-it-yourself fixer if you're on a somewhere in the middle of nowhere and a cable comes loose or whatever it is, the mechanical shifting is simpler to deal with or more easily dealt with if something goes wrong. And so if you want mechanical shifting, and if that's where your mindset is, Campagnolo is still build the supreme mechanical shifting system if what you want is long-term reliability and durability. Same thing, Shimano and SRAM make great mechanical shifting systems, but the Campagnolo is the one that's designed to be able to be repaired and replace parts and kind of keep going forever. And I pick cars over the more expensive options just because I look at that mindset as being a little bit no frills. You know, there's nothing extra there, but what's there, is the best that they make without the frills. And so I sort of the logic between picking those two component groups.
So the one thing we really haven't talked about, although you alluded to it because we were waiting for forks, is when people are going to start ordering bikes. Is that like soon?
We'll find out.
No. Oh, let me rephrase the question. When can people start ordering bikes? That was very good, Ben.
Right now.
Like
right
today. Now. Jump on that website.
Like today. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that is so cool. And so there's a lot more on the site. I wish we had hours and hours and hours to talk, which we have done before, but not, unfortunately, on the air. And I guess they can just contact you and you're willing to have some sort of a conversation. What other projects are you working on? Like this one wasn't enough, by the way.
Like this one wasn't enough. In the short term, there's a lot of little things that we have to catch up on with what we see there. So we're working on a very small accessories line, and in time, that will come out. I'm working on next bikes.
Because, of course, 2 in 11 sizes isn't enough.
Exactly. A lot of people have written over the last couple of years longing for something in titanium, or they loved their Outros and are missed out on getting an Outro. And so I'm considering many things and working on some aspect of design that could be applicable, in a variety of configurations. But I'm intrigued by many things. In the time that I spent doing work with a bike share company and experimenting with some electric assist bikes, I'm really watching what's happening there. I think electric assist is a fantastic addition to the cycling world in a variety of ways. I'm watching and tinkering with a lot of different things, but right now I'm focused on really finishing the details that aren't quite ready to go along with to Hinamoto Mio, which is some accessories and maybe what will be available a year from now.
Well, Ben, it is so nice to talk with you again. It is so nice to have you back.
Well, likewise.
Again, it is SaratadesignStudio.com. It launched today, January 8th. I'm very, very excited for you, and good luck with all your new projects.
Thank you so very much, Diane. Thank you very much.
All right. We'll talk soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ben Cerrada joined me for our conversation about his new website, CerradaDesignStudio.com, and his thinking about the bicycle marketplace today. So let's take a break, and then it's off to Nice, France, to talk with author Max Leonard. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Well, we're back, and it's off to Nice, France, via Skype, to talk with Max Leonard about his new book, Higher Calling. Hi, Max. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
How's London?
Well, not in London, actually. I'm in Nice. It's not as nice as you would think for the French Riviera in the wintertime, but it's definitely better weather than London anyway.
Oh, and it's definitely better weather than Cleveland, too, I can tell you that.
I managed to get out on my bike today, so that was all good.
Oh, that is good. Well, I've been wanting to talk with you about your new book, Higher Calling, but I had to wait until it actually got published, which it was January 2nd. So tell us a little bit about Max, your cycling history, where you grew up, and how you came to be a writer.
Okay. I grew up in London, in the center of town, and I've cycled a lot as a kid, and then I guess in my teenage years and at university, it's the same old story that beer and partying and that kind of thing took over. But I took it up again, like I was probably in my early 20s, and I was living in a place called Brighton, which is down by the coast. It was on the coast by the sea in the south of England. And I had a friend who lived in Eastbourne, which was like 25 miles along the coast. And I kept on saying to him, oh, I'll ride over to see you one day. I had a really old bike that I just rode around town. And eventually I said it so many times that I felt like I had to do it. And I struggled over the cliffs and up and down these beautiful roads through beautiful countryside on the English coast. And I was kind of hooked from there. And I had to get off on some of the hills and I was absolutely terrible. But yeah, I was kind of hooked. And, you know, it went from there. Then I did a ride to Paris and then I rode through the Alps. And that was really when I first hit the mountains that everything really clicked for me, I guess.
This book is about the mountains. The book is Higher Calling, Cycling's Obsession with Mountains. And it's not just in Europe. It's here, too, I guess. It is about the relationship riders have with the mountains. So tell us about the book. Set the stage for us about Higher Calling.
Well, I wrote a book called Lantern Rouge, which is about the Tour de France and the last guy in the Tour. And really, I was thinking for quite a long time about what to write next. And it wasn't really very clear to me. After a while, I just kind of thought, what is it that most cyclists or most road cyclists I'm talking about, I guess, you know, what unites us? And really, I think that most road cyclists love, for some bizarre reason, going uphill. And everyone would like to be a better cyclist when they're going uphill. That seems to be a kind of mark of excellence for everyone, from Chris Froome to the lowest amateur, and we all want to go faster uphill. And for some reason, that's really the test of a good cyclist. And so I love the mountains. I love riding there. And certainly when I rode through the Alps the first time, it kind of changed my outlook and changed what I wanted to do with my life, I guess. Once I sort of had that as the hook, I kind of broke it down into different aspects of this fascination with mountains, because obviously there's pro cycling. So, you know, the Tour de France, the Giro d'Italia, that kind of thing. And often the races are won in the mountains. And definitely for spectators, I would argue that the most interesting bit is when you get to see those beautiful helicopter shots and the crowds at the side of the road and the riders battling out in kind of slow motion because they're going uphill for so long. And so there's definitely a pro cycling aspect to it. But then there's also amateurs like me or anyone else, and actually we can all go riding in the mountains, and we all want to, and we all follow the pros up there. even though we're not really well trained and maybe we're overweight, but we'll find something in that experience. And I really wanted to dig into what that was. It's really interesting, kind of the physiology and what lets us, you know, everyone wants to be a bit fitter and ride uphill a bit faster. But what happens when you ride uphill? You know, what are the effects of altitude? How do you train? And I didn't really want to write a training manual, but I felt that was interesting, and how pro cyclists often go and live at altitude for a while to train for the big races. And then I guess final thing, but one of the things that was most important to me was the, I guess you call it the holistic aspects of being in the mountains. So the kind of the culture, the history, the things you see around you, because when you're going uphill, you're spending so much of your time going quite slowly. And I guess like I, you know, spend quite a lot of time in the mountains. So I started looking around and sort of questioning, why are there roads here? Why is there a kind of hydroelectric power station here? Why is there a fort? You know, what's the point of view of the shepherd who's by the side of the road with his sheep at 2,500 meters, you know, like 8,000, 9,000 feet up, you know, in the alpine meadows. So really, for me, that was a process of discovery, of trying to pin down what it was I got from it, apart from my kind of physical experience of going uphill. You know, what really engaged my brain, and what would it kind of enriched my experience of cycling, I guess.
I'm speaking with Max Leonard. His new book, Higher Calling, Cycling's Obsession with the Mountains, has just been published January 2nd. You know, you used a term in Higher Calling that I had never heard before, Everesting. And I think, and I mean, I got it right away, but I'm not sure that my listeners know what it means. Tell us what Everesting is.
Everesting is a really strange, I guess you'd call it an internet phenomenon. And it involves riding up and down the same hill repeatedly until you've climbed the same elevation as Mount Everest.
That's insane. That's just crazy.
It's kind of insane. And, you know, this is one of the psychological aspects of cycling. And it's 8,848 meters, which is 29,029 feet. And so if you're going to do an Everesting in the south of England, like the hills are maybe only 300 feet or 400 feet up. So, you know, I had to do it. I did an Everesting and I went up and down the same hill 68 times to make the right vertical gain to have climbed the height of Mount Everest. It was kind of taken up by a bunch of Australians called the Hell's 500, who really like climbing mountains. And they set it up as an internet challenge, and they've got a map on their website, and you can kind of claim your hill. And the only rules you've got to have is that it's got to be recorded online, and you're not allowed to go to sleep in your attempt. So it will probably take you the best part of the day and some of the night as well. But you just go up and down and up and down and up and down until you've reached the height of Everest.
How many people do you think have actually done this?
It's running into the thousands. When I don't remember when I started looking at it, but definitely there are only a few. There's maybe 20 or 50. And when I did an Everesting, there were, I don't know, maybe 100 people who did it. But it's sort of taken off. It's really hit a nerve with cyclists around the world, and it's a way of challenging yourself and I guess sticking a pole in the ground to show what you've done. But actually the history of it's really interesting, because it was invented, if I can use that term, by a guy called George Mallory, who is a South African but lives in Australia. He's actually the grandson of George Mallory, the famous British climber who tried to climb Everest in 1923-24 and sadly was lost on the mountain, and his body wasn't found until 2008, 2009, I don't think. But George Mallory Jr., the grandson, had been invited to go climb Everest on foot, you know, as you know, mountain climbing. And so he was saying to himself, he was a very accomplished mountain climber to begin with, but he said to himself, what can I do to train for this attempt? Because surely any training you can do, well, you can't do anything too hard training for Everest, you may as well make something as grueling as possible. And so he decided he was going to ride his bike up and down his local mountain until he got up to the same height as Everest. And it took him a fair few attempts, but he did it eventually. And then he went up Everest. He was really pleased to know he was one of the fittest guys there. And then this was in the 90s, and it kind of disappeared after that for a while. But he wrote an article about it for an Australian website, and these guys took it up, put it online, and it's gone completely viral. And they're now, at one point, I don't know about now, but at one point there were sort of 10 or 20 or 50 people, you know, chucking themselves up mountains every weekend doing an Everesting. It was really strange.
It is strange. Now that you've not only told me about it, but you've written about it in your book, you're going to see a lot of that here in the States, I'm sure, if they don't know about it already. But probably they do. It was just me. I had just never heard anything about it.
No, it's a bizarre kind of subculture, I guess. But it really illuminates one of the points that I guess was one of my starting premises of the book, was that a lot of cyclists, or a lot of road cyclists especially, really, really like going uphill. And it's not so much about the downhills, but it's something about the challenge of going uphill and something in there that really grabs them. So that was something I wanted to explore. And Everesting, I guess, is an extreme example of that and helps you really dig down into the emotions and the psychological challenge and that kind of thing, which I guess we all experience, or something like that.
I guess so. Your book is really a lot about history, and it tells some amazing stories. And I wonder if we could just talk about a couple of the stories in the book. One of the most interesting, although I found it utterly sad, is that of a man named Potier.
Yeah.
He was the first. Now, you'll have to tell me if I say this right. Grand Grimpeur. Tell us that story and what that means.
Yeah, he was. René Potier was a cyclist right back in the 1900s and very early years of the Tour de France, which was set up in 1903. At the time, the Tour de France was run by a newspaper, and so the newspaper would hype up all the riders and really, you know, present them as these kind of big characters to the audience. Potier was really like super talented, and he rode on the track and he rode, you know, everything, but he was also a very, very, very good climber. And back in those days, they were just evolving the kind of different sections of the Tour de France. So the King of the Mountains competition, the climbing mountains classification as we know it today, didn't exist. But it was in a report about Potier in 1905, 1906, that the Tour boss, Henri Desgranges, coined the phrase King of the Mountains. So I think it's fair to say that he was the first King of the Mountains. And one of the feats that he took on was one of the big mountains in the Vosges region of France called the Grand Ballon. At this time, they didn't even know if people could, you know, had the strength to ride up mountains, or, you know, if they could do it without putting their feet down. Or it was all like a massive era of discovery and kind of innovation and pushing the limits, which is really, really interesting to read about. And he went up this mountain so fast that he was the only guy who did it without putting his feet down. And just think, they only had one gear in those days. And often were riding on a fixed wheel as well. And this mountain was right near the local Peugeot factory, which is his bike sponsor. So there were thousands of guys on the hill clapping him up. And he was really, really well loved. But in some ways, I guess he made the template for climbers as we know them, because the climber as a figure in pro cycling has for quite a long time, I suppose, sort of been seen as a loner, someone who's quite introspective maybe, or has sort of difficulties relating to the world. And there's lots of people you can cite, you know, in the history of cycling to kind of back this up. But like, there's a guy called Charlie Gall, who was a Luxembourger, and he was a very beautiful cyclist in the 1950s. And he ended up after his career. He loved riding in the rain and would beat anyone up the hills in the rain, but he didn't like riding in the sunshine. And after his career, he retired and lived in forest on his own for, I don't know, 20 years, something like that. And nobody really knew where he was. And the other kind of famous example from more recently is Marco Pantani, who was a very troubled Italian rider in the mid and late 90s. And who tragically died of a drug overdose. Very, very accomplished and beautiful bike rider.
Yep.
Potier was sort of in the same mold. I think he had difficulty relating to the world. I don't think the fame sat very well with him. And nobody really knows what happened or why it happened. But one day he was found by his trainer hanging in the bike store where they all kept their bikes. And nobody knows why he committed suicide. And left behind a wife and a child, and he was in the kind of full flourish of his career. So it's a very sad story, and sort of I wouldn't want to brand climbers with this kind of unhappy legacy, but certainly there's something in there that has endured over the years.
It was a sad story, but again, it's sort of an example of the kinds of stories that are in the book. You run the gamut. You don't just tell sad stories. You tell some happy ones. One of the wonderful stories is prefaced by your three categories of truth. It's on page 95, and you start with a nod to Donald Rumsfeld, which cracked me up. There are at least three categories of truth that pertain to the Tour de France. You have true truths, untrue untruths, and true untruths. It's just, you'd have to go through. I mean, they all make sense once you read them. But I think that the story that illustrates your true untruths is about René Vietto and his toe. You want to tell that story?
Absolutely. I like the Donald Rumsfeld thing. It's you know, playing on his, like, there are the known knowns and the unknown knowns and the known unknowns, and which was something he said
right
when he was a defense secretary, I think. And what I like about Tour de France stories and about the history of the Tour de France is that we've got so far, because there's been so much myth making and so much hype from the newspapers and so much, I guess, Chinese whispers around the whole event for so long, is that there's all these incredible stories about the Tour, about, you know, feats of amazing daring and physical prowess and crazy things happening. And quite a lot of them, I think, are probably not 100% true, or not true in the way that they're told, or you know, have a basis in truth, but have just been embellished over the years. And René Vietto was one of these. He was a French rider who was a big French superstar in the 30s. And then he continued riding after the war, though arguably the Second World War robbed him of the chance to really make the most out of his career. And he was one of these climbers who was kind of taciturn and introspective and a very, very beautiful bike rider, and would climb like an angel. And he looked great on the bike. And he, as a young man, he would sort of beat anyone on any climb if he wanted to. But, you know, sometimes he wasn't feeling it. And so he was a troubled figure, let's say. But he was also very determined, and he was known for a story which I read in a few places, which sounded to me like an urban myth, in that in one Tour de France in 1947, he injured his toe and it went septic. And the story goes, at least, that instead of abandoning the Tour, he decided on the rest day of the Tour to get his doctor to amputate his toe, and then he continued riding. So that's the first believable or unbelievable thing, depending on how you see it. And then the story continues that this toe was then kept in a jar, preserved in formaldehyde, and then left behind a bar in Marseille for years. I mean, it sounds like just totally bizarre that you'd find a toe in a jar, and that this guy was such a hard nut that he, you know, he'd cut off his toe and keep on riding the Tour de France, which is, after all, one of the most, you know, difficult sporting events anyone could take part in, especially in those days when they were doing, you know, they were doing 300 miles at a time some stages. But I heard the story so many times and in so many different sources that I thought there's got to be something in it. So eventually I went to Marseille and started going around the bars and looking for the toe.
And of course you did.
Yeah, I mean, it seems obvious, doesn't it? And, you know, maybe this wasn't the best strategy for finding the toe, but I did have a backup. I'd found an old guy who lived in Marseille called René Bertrand, who was a very good friend of René Vietto. Vietto died in something like 1990. And René Bertrand, who's now in his 80s as well, was a dealer of bicycles in Marseille, and he knew all the local professionals, and he was a distributor of René Vietto's bicycles when René Vietto retired, because he started up a bicycle brand. Bertrand was probably René's biggest fan. And so I went to chat to him, and we talked about his legacy and about what an amazing rider he was, and, you know, his kind of introspective qualities and his hardness, and about how he was really a very sensitive guy and this kind of thing. And right at the end of the interview, we were in his apartment, which was just a treasure trove of cycling memorabilia from Tour de France, from different races, and pictures of him with like loads of great champions, that kind of thing. And at the end, I said, "And what about the toe?" And he said, "Oh, the toe, yeah." And went into his kitchen.
No, really?
Yeah. Well, actually, to be fair, not. He had two apartments. One of them was just really for keeping all his memorabilia together. So this wasn't the kitchen where he would make his lunch, I don't think. But he went into the kitchen, like went down into the cupboards, had like a little scrabble around, and came out with this weird-looking little thing in a jar. And it was René Vietto's toe.
Oh, my goodness. It was a true, untrue, true story.
No, I thought it was a story that it could be a total fabrication. But, you know, the fact that we all kept on talking about it would... You know, it told us something about the Tour de France and the hero worship and how tough you had to be to ride it. So even if it wasn't true, it definitely sort of had an emotional truth, I guess, or something like that. But actually, I talked to Bertrand about it. I talked to Vietto's son. And I don't think the circumstances are quite like the urban myth goes. I think, yes, he hurt his toe. Yes, he rode the Tour de France with a hurt toe, but he didn't have it cut off on the rest day. I think he actually got his doctor to pump him full of penicillin and he continued, and then it was amputated afterwards. I mean, even so, to think that you could just keep riding and be competitive in the world's biggest bicycle race with a toe that needed amputating, it's beyond belief. But then, you know, you see in modern times as well that that riders, you know, have that capacity to go beyond themselves. And I just thought that was a great story, and I was really pleased to work out whether it was true or not.
Yeah, really. Once again, we're speaking with Max Leonard about his new book, Higher Calling, Cycling's Obsession with Mountains. The last story I'd like to talk about before we sign off is not about an actual racing competitor like a Grand Tour rider, but a randonneur rider named Pierre Kramer. It touched me so much because I know so many randonneur riders. You talk about him and about Tom Simpson, who was the rider who died on Vont 2 in 1967. Just tell us a little bit about Pierre Kramer and what you discovered.
Yeah, Kramer was, as you say, an Audax rider, a randonneur. Well, I should start really by saying Tom Simpson has a memorial on Vont 2, and everyone knows about it. And I think it was 40 years last year since he died, or even 50 years since he died. So there's been a lot of celebration of his life. And if you go to Vont 2, you most likely leave a bidon or something behind on the memorial as a mark of respect. But about 100 meters up from the Tom Simpson memorial is another one, and nobody ever seemed to go to look at it. And it just sort of sits there and it's kind of invisible. So I went to have a look at it, and it was dedicated to a guy called Pierre Kramer. And it said that he died on Vont 2, I think it was Easter Sunday. It was the start of April 1983. So I thought, who is this guy? I want to look him up. So I did some research and found that he was a big member of the Audax Union Francais, the French Audax Union, and was well known for being like really generous with his riding, with helping people out on the road. He did all the big randonnée and brevet in France and in Europe. So he did Paris-Brest-Paris several times and everything else he could. And he would be a road captain and help people through. And there was nothing but good things that I heard about him. And then I read a story as well that at the age of 59, I think it was, he was told that he had been afflicted with incurable cancer. And then the story goes that he decided to go up Vont 2 on the Easter weekend when it was still snowy and just sit down in the snow and let the cold take him away, which I was very touched by as a story. And I don't really know how to explain it, but it sort of showed a kind of love of the mountains that was so deep and so pure, I guess. And I spoke to his family after this, and that wasn't the version of events that they knew about him. This was something that his friends from the Audax Union said, but they gave me such a beautiful picture of this nice guy, slightly standoffish, I guess, but, you know, really independent and strong-willed and just loved riding his bike and loved mountains and loved Vontu the most. And I guess it was a story I wanted to put in there because it summed something up for me, but also because, you know, the book isn't just about pro cycling. It's about all of us and why we want to go up there. So I was really, I was pleased to be able to put it in.
Yes, it's actually the story in the epilogue, and the book is wonderful. Once again, the book is called Higher Calling. It's by Max Leonard, Cycling's Obsession with Mountains. I think it's an excellent book, and I really, really enjoyed it. I have to ask you my three questions because I ask everybody I get to know a little bit on the show the same three questions. What's your favorite food?
Favorite food? Well, I'm in Nice right now, and I would have to say that we're about 35 kilometers, about 25 miles from Italy, and the pizza here is fantastic. And pizza as ride food is unbeatable for me.
Okay. And what kind of music do you prefer?
Oh, wow. I listen to all sorts. I don't listen to music on the bike that much. I like to be able to hear what's going on. But I guess when I'm at home, I listen to a lot of jazz.
Good for you. We were just talking about jazz here at the radio station, why we don't have a jazz show going on here. And then the last thing is, do you have any pets?
I would love to have pets, but my life at the moment is too peripatetic. I don't stay in one place often enough. But my family has dogs, and if I settle down for long enough to have a pet, I would definitely get a dog.
Well, Max, thank you so much for talking with me. The book, again, Higher Calling, Cycling's Obsession with the Mountains. I assume we can get this pretty much from the usual suspects?
Yeah, absolutely. All good bookshops, as they say. And it's, out with Pegasus.
Okay. Well, thanks for talking with me. And thanks again for writing such a nice book.
Oh, well, I'm so pleased you enjoyed it. And thank you so much for having me on.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Max Leonard's new book, Higher Calling, is available at your favorite bookseller, as well as through the publisher site, Pegasus Books. Thanks to both Ben Serrata and Max Leonard for taking time to chat with me today. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'll be back next week with an interview with Chris Corsi. He's the mayor of Santa Rosa, whose city has come under great stress with the horrific fires and storms in California. So thanks for listening. I hope you have a fabulous week. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.